Okay, I'm back with you. And you can still hear me?
Great.
Yep.
Good. It's, I know Jitsi, especially if you're doing a podcast, it can be a little more of an uphill battle than just kind of using Zoom or something, but...
I respect it. Good for you.
I figured it's the same, you know, David versus Goliath thing that we are all dealing with open source and decentralization versus the incumbent.
It's time for the Access of Easy podcast.
Hey everybody, it's Mark Jeftovic here with Access of Easy Salon number 19. We're recording this a day early so Charles and Jesse can't make it, but we have a very special guest. We have Bill Ottman, the CEO and co-founder of Minds.com. How you doing, Bill?
Hey. Yeah, so what's on your mind? What's at the front of your attention in this insane world?
Well, I think, you know, the focus or what's all-consuming obsession with me these days is the big tech. I don't want to call it censorship. I think it's something other than censorship. I think it's more of like a quasi-monopoly and an abusive market position. But the way that narratives today are being shaped by big tech, shaped by big media, often working hand in glove with each other, pushing down dissenting voices. And it's not just crowding out dissenting voices. It's that whole delegitimization of dissenting voices, where if you say something that is not 100% in agreement with the prevailing zeitgeist, not only are you wrong and someone to be disagreed with, but you're alt-right, you're a racist, you're a deplorable, you are illegitimate, you don't even have a claim to be able to voice a separate opinion. And and that's kind of been a focus of Access of Easy, which has sort of taken on a life of its own over the past couple of years. And so watching your work is what sort of, I think, prompted, you know, when you guys said, do you want to talk to Bill Ottman? I'm like, yeah, love to, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I tend to sort of agree that it's more complex than just censorship. And, you know, big tech is a multi-headed beast. And it's really just a knotted web of hypocrisy, really. Because, you know, they do some incredible things. They do contribute some important open source tools, but they're very well aware of the power dynamic at play in sort of open source versus proprietary. And, you know, it seems like you have certain policy decision makers that are clearly running the show in a certain regard above the real tech people who, you know, and these policymakers are creating these terms that actually do not make sense, and they are inconsistent, and they don't know how to enforce them. Because guess what? When you create inconsistent, incoherent terms of service, you can't enforce an inconsistent terms of service, because there's this thing called context and nuance with regards to speech that, you know, needs to be accounted for. And that's why, you know, certain people are able to get away with saying certain things and others aren't. And we just need to take speech on like a very case by case contextual basis. And, you know, we can't rely on AI to do, you know, it can help us. It can help us find things, but we can't rely on it to just, mass delete. And I think that they've sort of cornered themselves. So now that they've gone down this path, coming out into more of a free expression ethos is very difficult.
You know, I've never really thought of that before. My other sort of obsession is thinking about economics and financial history and that sort of thing. And I think about how the central banks have painted themselves into a corner because they've held the lid on interest rates for so long, and now they can't take their foot off the brake, and it would be complete bedlam if they did. And I never thought of it. It's the same dynamic now with civil discourse and the town square, that because there's been all of this manipulation or shaping of the narrative, that if someone were to take a step back and say, okay, we're going to just completely take our foot off the brake, how unhinged does it suddenly get very quickly? And actually, it brings me to a practical question, because alternative platforms like Minds and some of the others are trying to start out of the gate without having that manipulation and stuff. And do you find that there's almost a catch-22 in that situation? So you set yourself up, yeah, as a free speech, bastion of free speech, and then suddenly you're attracting the people who need that bastion to express themselves, and some of them may not be the kind of people you would want to break bread with or be marooned on a desert island with.
Absolutely. It is a sort of a paradox, and you know, you end up supporting unintentionally people that you wouldn't necessarily be trying to support, but you know, for principle's sake, you have to, and you know, I'm happy to. But it builds on itself as well. So like you're saying, but the funny thing is that Twitter and Facebook and YouTube all started off as talking about free speech. I mean, Twitter's slogan was free speech wing of the free speech party. I mean, back, you know, 10, 15 years ago, all of this radical speech was on there, and no one really seemed to have a problem because they liked that it was, you know, bringing democracy to the Middle East, and, you know, that there were these mass movements unfolding that were doing good things in the world, and we were seeing this incredible positive impact that an open platform can have around the world. And, you know, I think that now that the magnifying glass is just seeking out all of the controversial speech and really trying to make this huge deal about something that has been going on for, you know, decades, it's not to say that there should be no responsibility to... Okay, go ahead. It's not to say there should be no responsibility to moderate. Obviously, there should be, but it's like, how do you moderate? And what actually effectively de-radicalizes and depolarizes the internet? You know, ultimately, discourse does. So rather than having these moderators just banning everything haphazardly, it's like, what if you had 20,000 content moderators engaging in discourse, and they were like mental health people and different researchers and people, you know, we've partnered with Daryl Davis and some other de-radicalization orgs to take it head on. And I mean, Daryl de-radicalized over 200 members of the KKK literally by befriending them. And, mm-hmm. and you know, you're not going to change anyone's mind by banning them. It's impossible. You're making it physically impossible to change their minds.
Right.
So, I mean, even from just like a perspective of physics almost, it's like this is an empirical issue, and they're not approaching it empirically. They're just thinking about PR. But I'm glad that the data is ultimately on our side, and I'm really confident that we're ultimately going to be able to show that we're able to de-radicalize more people than they are. And in fact, you know, you wonder why the world is exploding right now. Well, guess what? I mean, the social media platforms are fueling this unrest.
You really got something. I mean, you're totally right there. I was actually realizing this morning, like about an hour ago before I was getting ready to come on here, my wife's like, "What's the matter?" You know, and I'm like, "I feel really bummed out today." And I realized it was because I spent more time on social media this morning than I normally would, just to get ready for this podcast. I was kind of looking back at, you know, and I was just like, this is depressing me. And I do notice that on days that I do spend too much time on social media, I am more prone to feeling that way. Now, I mean, we talk about this in the other salons as well. All of this is sort of compounded by lockdown stress that everybody is kind of going through right now. When in the early days, there was this extreme content that I think ran across the entire spectrum, and it seemed less polarizing because it was almost ubiquitous, or I guess uniformly distributed. Everyone could retreat to their respective echo chamber and shoot barbs at each other across no man's land. Do you think that there is a bias these days in the big tech enforcement of their so-called acceptable use policies, where one, left of center political extremism is tolerated, and anything to the right of Stalin is demonized? And
I think there's definitely a bias, but I think that, I mean, for instance, just this last week we saw Facebook banned like hundreds of far left Antifa accounts.
I noticed that, actually. I was going to mention that on this question
as
well.
And so, I think that I think Facebook's content policy is an absolute disaster.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
But at least they're starting to be a little realizing they have to be consistent with regards to, threats and calls for violence and, people kind of inciting riots and this type of stuff. So I do think that there's ultimately bias. I think most of the decision makers are generally leaning left, but at Facebook, Twitter, Google. But the funny thing about Facebook is you've got like Peter Thiel on the board,
mm-hmm.
you got libertarian voices in there. So I'm pretty sure that, and I read an in-depth article about wars within Twitter about free speech. I mean, there is internal battle happening. There are people inside trying to push towards a more internet freedom focus, but it's just not even close to getting through, and it's not going to get through because, again, like they're cornered. So I think that yes, the policies are biased, the AI is biased, but I think that the conservative establishment is, they've been going really hard on this. We're seeing executive orders, we're seeing the whole conservative end of the spectrum sort of freak out about social media censorship. So I think that the networks are starting to realize that they have to throw some bones in terms of at least being consistent. But at the end of the day, it's irrelevant, really, these tiny changes that they make. They're still stuck in a totally restrictive, damaging structure.
And if we jump to the other sort of extreme or flip side of what we're talking about, is a completely uncensorable dialogue a desire itself? I mean, you run a social media platform, I run an infrastructure supplier, we have to make these calls sometimes. When Daily Stormer got kicked off of every registrar under the sun, they did come to us and we said no, and we actually took a bit of heat for saying no to them. Yep. But it was, and I won't even go into the reasons why unless we sort of get there, but in my work with the ENS working group, I went to England for the first working group meeting, and they're trying to design the protocol spec and the policy spec for the Ethereum smart contract registry for ENS. And the very first thing, one guy just stands up and walks up to the whiteboard. He says, okay, we obviously don't want child porn and what else? And everybody's just kind of like, whoa, 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 whoa. I mean, no, we're not arguing to allow that, but you've just jumped way down the road on an implementation goal that we haven't even got there yet, right? And so over 3 days, I think they started to realize P2P DNS is trickier to get right than people may have thought going in. Uncensorable you know, how desirable is it? Is it desirable? And then they kind of settled towards, you know, the second layer solution, right? That we'll try and have as much open discourse or open registration as possible. And if there's any moderation or attenuation to happen, it's going to be user configurable at a second layer.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, we take a pretty balanced approach in regards to this. We're about to make a big announcement, which I could tease. So, you know, we have central servers, and we sort of have decentralized components of the network, like, you know, some of our peer-to-peer payment systems on Ethereum and you know, Bitcoin integrations, and we play with WebTorrent, and we're going to be giving users the option to post to a fully decentralized, uncensorable database. It'll be an option, though. Mm-hmm. And so I think that it's all about the option. And even within the option, you know, there's danger. We're not going to be managing that decentralized content storage system. And I'll tell you after. And once we announce it, I'm happy to come on here like right away.
Okay.
Who exactly it is, but they're doing incredible things, and it's very reliable and very fast, generally speaking. And so I think that there is a paradox within it, because uncensorability is simultaneously preventing us from burning our history, and it's also scary in the sense of like all knowledge is just permanent. I mean, all information is permanent. I mean, that bad stuff could get up, private information could get stuck there. And so, you know, the way that the project that we're working with is solving it is basically a consensus mechanism between nodes where they can, it is fully permanent, but the nodes can create different content policies and decide which content they're going to host. And so basically they can adopt these quote unquote content policies, which can sort of disregard certain information. But if somebody were to launch their own node and be like the fully uncensored node, it could still access it. But if majority of the nodes are not, so, and I think that ultimately there's really no other option. I mean, you can have more ephemeral type databases, but there's tons of problems associated with that as well. Like, you do want reliability. And so it is a huge paradox. There's dangers, there's immense safety that comes with it. And so it's not an easy issue.
I know. I mean, we've got a domain here. I won't mention the name, but it's one of these, it's like a tattle website where people, if their spouse cheats on them, they post it on this website.
Right.
And so all the time we are getting people coming to us saying, this has got to come down. And we're like, look, we're just the domain registrar. That's the only thing we are. But we get a steady stream of court orders coming in, and we forward them on, and they take them down. But every time it happens to me, I think somebody someday is going to put this site on a blockchain, and there's going to be no taking it down. It's going to be, once it's there, it's there. And sometimes the requests to take it down are from the people who actually posted the content. And
exactly. People don't even know if they, what they really want when,
or they're angry at the time. And
yeah, know. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, are you familiar with the Manila principles?
I am not. Why don't you take us through it?
So, the Manila Principles are it's a document that was drafted by EFF and a number of other digital rights groups, dozens. And it really just talks about how digital intermediaries, whether it's DNS or social networks or whatever it is, should just maintain neutrality and actually should not take down content without court orders. Now, I do think that there's gray area here. And so, like, when you're dealing with a social network or any platform, you know, you have malicious actors, you have spam, you have bots. I mean, you're not going to get a court order to take down bots. So I do think that, you know, that's there's flexibility there, but it's just really interesting to see, you know, EFF is, I think they still stick to this, but, you know, losing John Perry Barlow, I think, was a big hit. And there, it'll be very interesting to see if they can stick to the principles in the long term and not get pulled in into this political scene. But I'll just read the first paragraph.
Yeah, sure.
There's six premises of, if you go to manilaprinciples.org, you can see it. Okay. But intermediaries should be shielded from liability for third-party content. Two, content must not be required to be restricted without an order by a judicial authority. Three, requests for restrictions of content must be clear, be unambiguous, and follow due process. Four, laws and content restriction orders and practices must comply with tests of necessity and proportionality. Five, laws and content restriction policies and practices must respect due process. Six, transparency and accountability must be built into laws and content restriction policies and practices. And so, you know, this is something that I think not many companies are willing to get on board with these days, but it should be a no-brainer. And I think that the more leadership we can have from big tech companies to move back in this direction, because this is honestly where things used to be, mm-hmm. more so. And, you know, like you said, it was ubiquitous and it was way less of a problem. Isn't it interesting that suddenly now that every piece of controversial content, you know, now that the magnifying glass is on everything, we're seeing all of this unrest in society. Granted, there was always been unrest, and I think that I'm not acting like, you know, 20 years ago, 10, 20 years ago, there wasn't unrest. There certainly was, but specifically, it seems like we are seeing violence and radicalization occurring at a higher rate, and things seem to be amping up, at least from what I'm seeing.
Yeah, I think there's that sense is widespread, that there's almost a kind of quickening of the tempo. I mean, I do see the historical parallels. I think that's why I always tell my daughter one of the most important things you can study is history, because when you do see the parallels from the past, for me at least, it helps me calm down a little bit today when I realize, well, you know what, people have always been up in arms and hysterical, like, for as long as there's been a way to communicate that. But I, having said that, I think you are correct that there seems to be, it's more intense, it's a bit more accelerated now. I think possibly the fact that we are, and I heard you talking about this on Joe Rogan, your appearance there, the whole, we're glued to our smartphones, we're in constant communication all the time, and it just kind of acts as an accelerant, I think, to this almost like a mind virus of contagion, hysteria, anxiety, and animosity, really. I mean,
yeah, and I think context, you know, what we're working on right now is sort of a mechanism so that when you're seeing content, whatever content it is, it's a cat meme or it's a, you know, some sort of crazy controversial piece of content, we're working on some visual mechanisms to communicate to the user and basically a methodology, a suggestion for how to engage and how to process whatever information it is that they're seeing without passing judgment necessarily. But I think that, you know, all this work that's being done by Daryl and in sort of the compassion de-radicalization movement, you know, making your enemies your friend, you know, that's how you make things more calm globally. If someone will so easily get triggered by seeing something that they disagree with, if they aren't approaching it with the context of, okay, I want to have like a compassionate experience right now, I want to have a human experience right now, there is a human over there through the screen, and there's just, it's like a human reminder. We need to have something like literally flashing on the post to remind people of that, because there's nothing productive about the hot take trigger warning culture that is just causing things to metastasize.
I remember, it's probably before your time, but in the mid 90s, there is like this phenomena of ASCII text e-zines, and there was one called Scream Baby. And I think the guy who put it out's name was David Smith. Not the same Dave Smith, who's the libertarian who does the podcast now, because he's too young, I think. But I remember an issue of that. He said, you know, never, ever forget that it's a human being on the other side of whatever it is you're typing, you know. And I remember that was one of the things that made a big impression on me at the time and was pulling me into, the whole online culture of the day. I'm sorry, I've got to just kill my phone here, which is ringing. I should just power that down. One of the Manila principles are, you know, that's a good catch-all set. And I think on our side, we sort of go by those rules without really being aware that they were called the Manila principles. What I do notice is that, even court orders, you want a killer application for blockchain. How about a blockchain that helps all these international jurisdictions coordinate their legal processes? Because even if you say, you know, material subject to a court order, where is the proper jurisdiction for that court order, you know, to have authority? Like, we basically say, because we're a Canadian company and we're incorporated in the province of Ontario, it's got to be valid here, which means if it's a foreign court order, you've got to get letters rogatory and have it executed here, and that introduces delays. I just got another one the other day. We're getting some sort of legal process from Russia. They never send translations. It just says, it's just in Russian and it has a date on it. I don't even know what domain it's pursuant to. There's no email address in it for me to just email somebody back and say, if you give me the English version of what you're trying to accomplish, I can at least give you next steps. And we have no idea. It's just some sort of Russian legal document that says something. And I suppose I could go out and find a Russian translator to translate it for me. But I just feel like that's not going to scale, right?
No, that's not going to scale. And you would, and I think that it's more than fair that the requester puts in the resources to, you know, making that a frictionless process. To say that a company based in a certain jurisdiction now has obligations to satisfy every global jurisdiction is just totally unscalable. It makes no sense. And no one does that. You know, we have a very similar stance. You know, we're a US company, Delaware, and we're going to abide by US law. Like, we're just not going to overcomplicate the situation right now. Twitter, Facebook, Google, they all have different policies in different countries and all different kind of moderation tech and flags in each country. And so there's like a different Twitter in Pakistan than you would see in the US. And but then, you know, the irony is that they won't play ball in China.
Mm-hmm.
They say, oh, no, we won't do business in China, but they will do business in, you know, very closely related authoritarian.
Are they saying regime. They won't do business in China? I thought that my impression is they're clawing over each other to do business in China. It's just on what terms will the Chinese government let them in? And Google was, they were doing business in China, and they had a minor revolt among their own employees over it, and they still keep going.
Are you talking about in Google, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, they had the whole Dragonfly project. Yeah, and then they sort of denied it was happening. But look, I mean, so yeah, that's exactly what's happening. They're negotiating with the Chinese government because the Chinese government wants the data pipes. They want to be able to, they want their content policy. Google probably does want a more liberal content policy. And so they're fighting about which version of Google is going to make it live over there. And but the reality is that no matter what, they're going to be making compromises compared to the US version. So I just think that from where we're at, you know, we need to stick to our principles. We're a small startup. We have no, there's really not, there's hardly any benefit to us compromising principles for some authoritarian country that is mad that someone's criticizing one of their politicians. It's just, it's not productive. What we would rather do is get banned. We just got banned from the Chinese App Store and a major Vietnamese ISP. And I would rather just talk with those decision makers, you know, hopefully set up a dialogue, try to educate them in the long term how their country will ultimately be healthier if they can move to more of a real kind of open discourse scenario. But they, you know, they seem to think that they can control this, but they will lose. The internet will win.
I like to think you're right, and that's actually my stated ideology as well. Are you familiar with the George Gilder book, Life After Google?
I remember hearing about it, but I didn't read it.
Yeah, it's good. And I thought of it when I was watching your Joe Rogan thing. It's like, this is, I wonder if he's read this book. But then the cynical, jaded, exhausted part of me worries that, you know, people don't care. You know, at the end of the day, they want what's easy and what's frictionless, and they have no, they pay no mind to the privacy and intellectual and personal freedom costs of doing this.
That is true. I think both things can be true at the same time. And what is exciting to me is that, well, look, at the end of the day, open source, decentralized apps need to have good UX. It needs to be just as easy. It needs to be easier, to be honest, because hitting network effects now is way harder than it used to be. It's easier actually in certain regards, but way harder in other regards because there's already the monopolies in place. Mm-hmm. But, you know, look at Bitcoin. I mean, if you look at how naturally viral Bitcoin is and how, you know, it's on a schedule, it's growing. It's showing no signs of slowing down. I feel like the open source movement in general is showing no signs of slowing down. It's a slow and steady climb, but it's gonna keep climbing. And I think, you know, it may take 20 years, but in 20 years, I would imagine just looking at how, you know, Linux took over, looking at how, you know, Wikipedia, Bitcoin, all, you know, WordPress, all of the major open source projects are just gaining steam. And it's going to happen in social networking. It's going to happen in DNS. It's going to happen across the board. It's a long game, but we can just look at the history of the internet to kind of see the patterns. And so It's gonna be difficult, and I don't think that they're gonna turn into, you know, Netscape. Well, I mean, what did Netscape actually end up turning into? Did they get bought by? Or did they just?
I can't even remember.
I can't remember either. But you know, they're not gonna go. Google and Facebook are not gonna go the way of MySpace. and just moving into irrelevancy.
Right.
They are going to be forced to change because their infrastructure is so epic and important that I would imagine we'll get to some sort of a tipping point where we have fully competitive open source decentralized apps with the same user base that are like, you know, you look at the top 10 websites in the world, it'll be like Google, Facebook, you know, and then like a couple open source alternatives, and we're going to be there neck and neck. Hopefully we get there. Probably, you know, who knows? That's very unlikely, but you know, we hope it's possible. And or someone else like us will get there, and then they, you know, you'll start to see they're going to start throwing out more open source code. They're going to start being a little bit more open. They're going to and they're going to start. I that's just a prediction. I because they already know this game.
One of the things that I say frequently in my writings when it comes to big tech is that they are incentivizing their own disruption. Because I think because they're misusing their dominant position, they're not nurturing it carefully. And one of the things we talk about in Access of Easy a lot is the defining tension of our time being between protocols and platforms, right? So maybe in the future, as this plays out, it's not going to be 10 top 10 sites. It'll be like maybe the top five of the top 10 are platforms, and five of the other five of the top 10 are some kind of protocol, an open source distributed protocol that is kind of known under some moniker that you and I wouldn't even recognize as a site per se, you know, like the Fediverse, for example, right? You've Minds is completely open source. Your code is open source. How's that going? Is there any notable forks of Minds or sites that have spun up using the code base?
We're getting approached by some big enterprise players right now. And because every major network should be running some sort of a social engine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to be running a major, whether it's a news network or a media network, or you know, there's so many huge tech companies that would benefit so greatly from having a social engine within their sites, because they have huge customer bases. You know, if you're talking support, you're talking just community, it has immense benefit. So I'm very interested in the Fediverse. It's one of those things that we've been saying we're going to do for a couple years, and we just keep getting pulled down other rabbit holes, like mm-hmm. others. Because the thing about the Fediverse is it's good, it's working, it coordinates nodes, but it's not actually decentralized. It's sort of quasi-decentralized. The nodes can still... sensor. So it's, mm-hmm. it's, you know, the policies on each node are still, you know, very subject to the same risks as central. It's really just smaller centralized networks talking to each other.
But I actually like that model because each node can set its own policies.
And yeah, I like it too.
And a user on a given node can say, well, your policy sucks, and they can just switch to another node or run their own node.
Yes, they can. And that's why I like it and support it and want to participate in it. I think it's a great thing. I want to get federated with all the different... ActivityPub is the protocol, and it's great. It's an important option. And I think that ultimately is what the solution is. I agree with you. It's not going to be like some centralized open source giant that competes on the same paradigm. It's going to be something a little bit more decentralized. So it may not be like some sort of singular network, which even makes it up there. But there's all these different tool sets. A blockchain's not going to solve all our problems. Fediverse is not going to solve all our problems. There's probably dozens of tools which are going to coalesce into some sort of solution, because I mean, the infrastructure behind Google and Facebook, you know, they're using many dozens of tools. So why would we think that in the DAP world, it's going to be any different?
Right. And, you know, researching this, looking a bit deeper into Minds, I have a Minds account actually, and I was posting a bit on there, and I do, it's a nice interface. It's nice and clean. I'm still trying to figure out my way around fully. Are you still facing the same kind of headwinds? Like, I remember once I was trying to post Minds on Facebook and Facebook was blocking me. And then I noticed even Twitter was blocking me. And like Vice wrote that hit piece. Like, I couldn't believe that hit piece.
If you actually read the hit piece, it's a hit piece that just uses big words or scary words, but it doesn't actually say anything of substance. I mean,
yes, they also put free speech in scare quotes, which like is an automatic disqualification for me. But
you know, overall our press has been great. I mean, we've gotten incredible. We've gotten, just in the last 3 months, we've had great mentions in The Economist, New York Times, and Quartz, and you know, all these sort of liberal-ish pubs. And so they don't really know what to make of us, because we are doing all these things that they agree with, but then, you know, the Nazis scare people. Granted, it's only a handful of Nazis, just like exist on every social network. So, you know, the guys at Vice basically disingenuously, I talked to those guys for like 2 hours. They made it seem like they were totally like in agreement with our approach at this. And then they come out, and then, okay, they went and they found a couple of, you know, pretty hardcore accounts, a couple of which we actually agreed, okay, yeah, these should get taken down. And then they go and they, you know, it's like their trophy room. You know, they're trying to say, oh, we got them to take down this kind of, it's like, all right, like, what are you bragging? Like, great job. Like, that's what a content moderator does. And you're not solving much. You know, to be honest, those people who got banned realistically just went off and got more pissed off and went deeper into the dark web. So that is the situation, though. I mean, when it comes to violence, we can't make compromises. So, I mean, there was the Vice part of your question. What was the other thing?
Well, I was just asking if you're still facing these kinds of headwinds, you know, this marginalization from the mainstream press. It sounds like you're making some headway, which is encouraging.
Yeah, I mean, we launched a whole jury system as well for our reporting process, which helped a lot. Fox News covered that really favorably. But, you know, again, back to the original issue where you were saying the catch-22, it's that we're really working hard now on decentralized reputation, because there are bad actors. That's a fact. There are people who try to manipulate social media. There are trolls. There are bots. There is spam. All of this. There are token farmers. You know, people trying to game our token system, and that's not cool. Mm-hmm. So we want to be. We don't want to create a centralized social credit score, but I do think that peer-to-peer rating systems, particularly in different categories, So that reputation can be built in different areas of expertise. I think that's a really cool idea. There's a lot of good work getting into like decentralized identity happening in that area. That also allows us to, you know, without surveillance, start to see who, you know, is getting. We need to build mechanisms to prevent mob activity, to just gang up on different users, because that certainly will happen, and we need to that's really the most important thing to prevent against, that we need to focus on. But the reason I brought that up is because when you have all the content across the spectrum, you know, some stuff that people don't want to see does fizzle up, and it gets into the recommendation feeds, and you know that causes problems for us. Like I even find I'm occasionally seeing things that I wouldn't particularly choose to see, but then again, it, like I fall into the trap even still of getting triggered by certain content, and so it always comes back to that sort of remembering that there's a human there. And because a lot of times people sign up, they'll see something they don't want to see, and then suddenly they start to think that we like somehow support this.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, it's the opposite. We don't support it. By having it on the platform is the only way that it could potentially shift consciousness. So it's that burden that we carry, and we just have to get better at building recommendation engines that aren't spying on people, that are showing people relevant stuff, and it's not any sort of a like nightmarish dystopia. So we gave ourselves literally one of the hardest puzzles to solve, because we could be we could bring in some proprietary AI and like clean things up real quick, pretty easily. We wouldn't even have to delete it. But we don't want to do that. It would save us so much time. And as a small startup with limited resources, like a lot of people would say you should do that because it's very risky to not do that. We wouldn't have had the growth that we have to this point without sticking to the principles, particularly the open source stuff. So, you know, that's our burden. And if it's a slower growth curve, I think that's okay. It's more sustainable in the long run.
Well, I agree with you there. What are your numbers looking like today?
We're just over 3 million users, probably like 300K active. So, you know, getting like 10 million month, 10 to 20 million, depending on the month, page views, probably like 3 to 4 million unique visitors. So, you know, not bad, but definitely still not, we need to get over that like million actives, mm-hmm. 10 million. It will start building on itself, but I think that we do, you know, churn is a big issue. I think a lot of people who, you know, check it out, and then it doesn't have all the bells and whistles that YouTube and Facebook have, so they say, okay, I'll come back. But we've been keeping our cards pretty close. We have not been like bombing people with emails or anything, and we're just waiting until, because it's all about retention and keeping people engaged without being annoying and providing the right incentive mechanisms. And you know, freedom is not enough, like you said, for a lot of people. And so it's a lot of it also has to do with making it easy for people so that they can, because no one has time to manage 10 different social media accounts. So, you know, building out the API so that we can be importing feeds from other places as well, making it easier for bigger creators to, you know, have more automated stuff happening. We just rolled out a YouTube importer, so that's helping. So YouTube uploads automatically, but it's
so you're
pick your wormhole.
You're fighting the good fight in my mind, and you're taking the long view. You're sort of a man after my own heart. We never took VC at Easy DNS. We have no outside investors, so it's been a much slower growth phase than, you know, some of the VC funded competitors and stuff. You've open sourced the code base. You have an Ethereum ER20 based token. What's the business model for Minds?
So
I want to caveat, you're not spying on your users, right? So you're taking out all the low-hanging fruit for how you make money in this business for a social media platform. What's the business model?
So multi-pronged, but we do have premium. We have two tiers of premium subscriptions, Minds Plus and Minds Pro. Plus, you can get rid of all the boosted posts and you can get access to a premium feed. Pro basically enables you enhanced monetization options, and pro users, we're about to roll this out, can when you compose a post, there's a monetization button. You can submit your post to the Minds Plus premium feed, and if it gains traction, we actually share a percentage of our revenue with the creators who help put viral content into that feed. So there's two premium subscriptions, you know, $5 a month or $15 a month. That's really important. That's really core, recurring, sustainable revenue. We also do sell the token, and then the tokens can be used to get advertising. So the only way to advertise right now is to buy the token and use the tokens to boost your posts.
Okay.
We sell the token, we count that, we hold the ETH and get rid of it on a monthly basis, and that's deferred revenue. And then when it's like a gift card, pretty much. So you buy a gift card, you know, typically on gift card P&Ls, they count that as deferred. And then when the gift card gets redeemed, that's when they recognize the revenue.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So we have that, and people can also buy our products with tokens, the premium products. So we have a subscription thing going on. We do advertising, but we just don't spy, which makes it a little bit less targeted,
mm-hmm.
but it is what it is. I mean, and then, you know, we're considering some transaction fees on some of the peer-to-peer stuff. But right now there's no fees for the peer-to-peer tipping and the membership tiers that channels can set up themselves. So we're really trying to get into a radical revenue sharing model where we're incentivizing the creators to bring their audience, bring their content, and that we'll basically share our premium membership revenue with the creators who are helping us drive that engagement in the premium feeds.
Okay. I like that idea. I would like to see that succeed. So,
yeah, I mean, you know, it's just interesting. Facebook and Twitter don't even have a membership at all. I mean, so I think sustainable recurring revenue is really the key. And, you know, obviously there always be free. You always will be able to use the site for free, but membership subscription programs are saving the media industry.
Mm-hmm.
And you're seeing a lot of, you know, print media move towards this, and you know, the businesses would be dying without it, because the malicious third party ads are just like the death of the internet.
Have you ever read Jaron Lanier's 10 Reasons to Delete Your Social Media Accounts Right Now?
No. Well, but I've already done it, so
yeah.
Well,
it all, he basically, if you could distill that book into one sentence, it's like ad, you know, free access, free ad-based revenue model is basically the source of all the ills with the social media networks.
Yep.
Absolutely. But, you know, for a guy like me, you know, and we can wind up soon. We've been going for about an hour. Maybe this is a good note to close out on. How do you pitch a guy like me? So I put out my weekly newsletter, right? Access of Easy goes out every week. I started off to my customers, and it kind of took on a life of its own because it's not a corporate newsletter. It just covers like privacy, censorship, tech, that kind of thing. And I hate Facebook and I hate Twitter. Like I don't hate it, but you know what I mean. It's just, I find it a bit of a buzzkill. And every day or every week, I'm like, I wish I could just delete my accounts, but I feel like I've got to be on there to, number one, collect data points to curate this newsletter, and number two, to disseminate the newsletter whenever I publish it. So what do you tell a guy like me to overcome that sort of network effect that you're fighting that battle on?
Well, first I would ask, you know, how's the engagement doing on Facebook?
It sucks.
I mean, isn't it? It sucks. That's the thing. That's actually, you know, that's a a good place to kind of come to the close on, because that's the great irony, is that the billions of users on Facebook don't matter if you can't even reach them, or you can't even reach your own followers on Facebook. So, because their algorithm just lets you reach like 5% of your own followers. Mm-hmm. So what I would say is that we have small to medium size creators who are getting more activity on Minds than they are on Facebook or Twitter. So, you know, for the huge influencers, like, yeah, we're trying to get them as much as possible. We have a handful of them, but, and, you know, ultimately that's absolutely crucial. But if you post that, I would be curious, and we should run some experiments, you know, get you some tokens, boost every post, and you earn more tokens for the engagement that you receive on your post. So it sort of builds on itself. I would bet that we could probably get you higher engagement on Minds than on Facebook.
You know what? Okay, I'm going to take you up. I'll buy the tokens. I'll come in as like, I'm just a regular small business coming in, going to try this as opposed to Facebook. We'll buy a bunch of tokens. We'll put out, it might take us a week or two to be ready to do it, but we'll start putting out Access of Easy on Minds, and we'll see how it goes. And if it goes better than Facebook, then maybe we'll drop our Facebook account and Twitter.
Yeah, let's A/B test it. I mean, we need to be able to... That's a great case study for us. So I'm happy to test it out. You know, I also don't tell people to, I don't typically try to convince people to leave those social networks, because it's not worth it. Like, people need to come to that in their own time. And, you know, ultimately it should speak for itself. You shouldn't have to pressure people to do it, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I wrote an entire book on how to defend yourself against deplatform attacks and cancel culture. And my whole thing is you use these social networks as your tentacles, right? And don't, the end goal of social media presence is not how many followers you have or how many likes you have. That is just a sort of a step in the funnel of how many followers does it take to get an opt-in to your email list? How many likes does it take to get someone to come back to your website and, you know, become a member of your own community, your own platform? I mean, the best engagement we get right now is via email. We send out Access of Easy via email, and that's where it pretty well all happens.
Absolutely, and that's direct, peer-to-peer, old school, and it's the best. That's why you see a company like Substack act really start to kill it right now, because they're just going old school.
Yeah, Jesse's MetaViews newsletter goes out on Substack, and Matt Taibbi's on Substack. I see a lot of people on that. What in closing? I mean, it's minds.com is where people are going to go. You do some blogging and stuff. Does all your blogging stuff go out exclusively via the Minds platform?
Yeah, everything's there. Find me at minds.com/Ottman.
Okay.
And yeah, let's follow up after this. So I'll get your username and we'll get connected and get you set up.
Okay.
Ready for a blast. I'm excited.
Well, I'm Mark JR on Minds. And what I'll do is I'll go in and I'll create a Easy DNS or an Access of Easy account, and we'll kind of go from there.
Nice, you're verified now.
All right, thank you. I got a blue check finally.
And it's not a popularity contest on Minds. If you can, we do like post KYC stuff. So
yeah,
if you're verified somewhere else, we'll you know, we're not handling all the sensitive information, but. That's a whole other rabbit hole to go down is validating identity. But man, let's do this again. This was really fun.
Yeah, it was. Okay, great. So Bill Ottman, minds.com, and this was Access of Easy, salon number 19.